Welcome to Indie Film Weekly, a No Film School podcast. I'm Liz Nord, editor-in-chief of No Film School.
And I'm John Fusco, producer at No Film School.
It's May 19th, 2016, and on this week's show, we've got an update from the Cannes Film Festival in France, a game-changing new streaming service from Amazon, a federal investigation into Hollywood, and as always, news you can use about gear, upcoming deadlines, new film releases, and our new feature, Ask No Film School. Welcome to this week's show, as always, from downtown Brooklyn, New York. We're here bringing you everything you might have missed while you were busy making films. We ourselves missed last week's show for the first time since we started running. Sorry about that, guys, but it was for good reasons. I was at the Asylum Arts Retreat in upstate New York, and just want to shout out to those guys. Thank you so much for having me. Emily was traipsing around the south of France at the Cannes Film Festival, and our big news is that No Film School's founder, Ryan Koo, is off to the races in pre-production for his feature film, Amateur, which is being produced by Netflix. So this has been a long time in coming, and he is now in pre-production. We'll be shooting in about a month, and we miss him already and wish him the absolute best of luck. And all that means that I will be having several different co-hosts. John last week was holding down the fort all by himself here. How'd that go, John?
It was lonely, but it was, I guess it was eye-opening, just how much work the four of us, or the three of us, I guess, well, the four of us, actually have to get done on a weekly basis. I got to work from home a little bit, which was nice, and I also did a great podcast with three international documentary filmmakers that went up earlier this week. Still got to come in and do that, and that went really well. Everyone should check it out. But yeah, it's good to have you back, and it's good. It will be good once Emily is back. There's just the two of us now this week still, because Emily is still in France. So we're still dealing with a lot of work, but I think it's going pretty smooth.
I agree. I'm so glad that you were able to hold down the fort, and I'm glad to be back. As mentioned, Emily Booter, our managing editor, is at the Cannes Film Festival, and since this is an audio show, I feel like I have to address the pronunciation of this festival. I think it's tempting to call it Cannes, and a lot of people do.
I do.
You do, and it looks like it should be, if you're trying to be sophisticated, pronounced con.
Sure.
But my high school French teacher, Mr. Roy, who was kind of pervy, let us all know that con is actually a dirty word for female anatomy.
What?
Another one that starts with C.
Okay.
And it is legit pronounced can.
Why even name it con then?
Because it's called can.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so now that that's all cleared up, I'm sure you've all heard of the festival. It's just one of the premier global destinations for films large and small. It's been going on since 1946. As I mentioned, it takes place in the glamorous south of France, and it's a very fancy festival. To this day, it seems crazy for 2016, but there's still articles coming out this year chiding certain stars for not wearing heels on the red carpet. I mean, it's that specific. But you know, indie films do have a place there, and it can launch them into a very successful trajectory. I mean, even Quentin Tarantino won the Palme d'Or 1 year for Pulp Fiction, and, you know, we all know what's happened to him. So even though it premieres, like, major Hollywood films, like, you know, Jodie Foster's film Money Monster with George Clooney and Julia Roberts is in the festival this year, they're not actually in competition. It's just a showcase for them where all the kind of industry people are. For us, it's very exciting this year because it's the first time we've had a reporter on the ground, and Emily's been pumping out tons of articles. She also sent us some of her impressions. She's totally loving it. She doesn't want to come home.
I'll be there next year, right? That's going to be me out there, hopefully.
We'll all be there doing this podcast live from the water, actually. Right? We're going to have a cabana.
Can't wait.
A floating cabana. Anyway, in the meantime, Emily's there repping us, and she you know, again, she doesn't want to come home, which is a little bit heartbreaking, but I understand. She said basically so far, you know, she really feels while she's there that it's the epicenter of global cinema. She said there hasn't been too, you know, much too crazy in terms of big new names or breakout items. A lot of the kind of classic Cannes directors are there, like Pedro Almodovar, Jim Jarmusch. There's a filmmaker, Maren Atta, who you might have heard of. She, interestingly, has the first German film to premiere at the festival in 10 years. And Emily said that her film, Tony Erdmann, is one of the most buzzed about so far, that everyone's been loving it, including Emily. And she's actually interviewed Maren, and that's going to be up on the site within the next couple of days. She also mentioned that one of the most divisive films so far at the festival is Personal Shopper, which is French director Olivier Assayas's drama with Kristen Stewart. And apparently, according to Emily, it's the only film that got booed at the press screenings this year, which is like pretty harsh. But at the same time, it got a standing ovation at the first public screening, at the non-press screening. So I would say, you know.
I mean, Kristen Stewart seems to be a pretty divisive actor among our audience, too. It seems like some people got a little bit upset that we were focusing on her. I think that probably stems from the whole Twilight stigmata, and she's had to, you know, break away from that. But it sounds like an interesting movie. It's a horror movie, if I'm right. It's about she's being haunted by something. I haven't heard too much about it, but I'm looking forward to hearing what Emily has to say about it next week when she gets back.
Yeah, I think she wasn't a fan, but she thought it took some interesting risks, so we'll see. And I totally hear you. I agree on the Kristen Stewart thing. I have mixed feelings, too. I admit I did see all the Twilight films and possibly read all the books in like one sitting, maybe.
Great.
Okay, I worked at MTV at the time. It was apropos.
Sure.
Anyway, so, you know, look, it's not really her fault. When you come up as part of, you know, as an actor, as part of a franchise, you're going to have a certain association with you. But I would say, like, it seems in recent years she's really taken an indie turn.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also just a problem that young female actors face in general, is they have to break out of that sort of stereotype which they first break into the industry in, which is that they're cute, attractive, girlfriend type roles, you know. It's a hard thing to break out of, especially when there aren't still that many beefy roles for young women actors these days.
Totally. That's a good point. I mean, Jennifer Lawrence is a good example of someone who's come up in a franchise, The Hunger Games, but has made a really strong impression on the indie circuit. So it's possible.
Yeah. But we'll stop talking about her because we might piss some of you off. So we'll keep moving.
Whatever. I'm going to keep talking just to piss some of you off. No. But anyway, so back to France. So far, we have several of Emily's posts up, and another one of our reporters, Dylan Kai Dempsey, also has written some things. We have a piece about Andrea Arnold's opening night film, American Honey. And by the way, you can watch her Oscar-winning short, Wasp, streaming for free at La Cinema Club until this Saturday, the 21st only. So check it out. I heard it's awesome. We've got some red carpet chat with Jodie Foster, an interview with the Russian filmmaker Kirill. Can you pronounce this one, John?
Serebnikov?
Wow, I bet that's right.
While you were reading Twilight, I was reading Dostoevsky, so.
Okay, snobberoo. Anyway, he made a controversial film called The Student about religious fundamentalism. And we have another interview that I found absolutely fascinating with the producer, Mohamed Hefsi, about how he and his crew shot the film Clash from the back of a truck in war-torn Egypt. So those posts are already up, and Emily's sending several more, so be on the lookout. In news closer to home, we've covered the well-documented gender gap in Hollywood on this show before. More recent statistics show that women directed only 7% of Hollywood films and about 14% of TV shows last year. And, you know, there are obvious issues and challenges with this, but now, prompted by the ACLU, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs are launching a full investigation to discover whether this is not just a preference issue but a legal one. They're basically asking whether unfair gender discrimination plays a role in this and therefore violates civil rights. So, you know, I'm happy to see that this issue is being taken very, very seriously at the highest federal levels. But also, meanwhile, grassroots groups are continuing to address the issue in more hands-on ways. We've talked about the female film directors collective that I'm part of called Film Fatales. There are lots more Some of the newest ones to launch, I'm actually particularly excited about. They are groups of female DPs. One is called Cinematographers XX, and the other is the International Collective of Female Cinematographers. They both have databases online so that you basically have no excuse anymore to say that you just can't find a female DP, because these websites are chock full of experienced women. And I actually did a post this past week where I did kind of mini profiles of several of them, asked questions. There's tons of great advice on there for any shooter. One thing I noticed among them is that the Arri Alexa is by far the favorite camera across the board. So,
is that a gender thing, do you think, or is that just like a filmmaking sort of trend?
I think it's a filmmaking trend. I think, you know, for women, it's a more handleable camera. Mm-hmm. It's not a big, huge, heavy camera. But yeah, it was just something I noticed. Like, these women are shooting all different kinds of things, commercials, docs, features. And all of them kept pointing to the Alexa. So just a little side note.
I know we had Ariana Lapenne, who was a founding member of Cinematographers XX, and her camera of choice was the C300. But I think that's probably just because, I mean, she has done some insane international guerrilla documentary work. She's just been everywhere, and, you know, she's had to have small kits and move around as easily as she can. You know, maybe it's just, again, there's no like right camera. It's the camera that fits your needs, sort of.
They all said that too. They all basically were like, you know, it depends on the job. But if I had to choose, although I think, you know, with Ariana, like, for sure, if you're doing international docs, not only do you want something versatile and small, but maybe you don't want to bring the most expensive possible camera.
Right.
Because who knows what could happen to it. But I got to say, I know you mentioned the podcast at the top of the show. I'm going to give an extra shout out for everybody that, you know, that's our most recent podcast before this one. So you can find it in our podcast stream. And it's so, so interesting. I think it might be one of our best episodes yet about kind of how do you prepare for shooting internationally in all kinds of, you know, guerrilla circumstances.
Some more big news for people who are looking to get their content distributed in sort of new, I guess, alternative ways, taking advantage of our millennial culture. Amazon Video Direct is really trying to change the streaming game by letting creators choose how they'll get paid. It's a move that could be very significant for us, indie filmmakers, because this is a streaming service that allows anyone to upload content and get paid for it. So it's kind of like YouTube in that sense, where if you want something monetized, you can see some return for it. But we've found here at No Film School that, you know, we're seeing pennies from that sort of business model. And it's nice to finally get a sort of alternative to that, especially when you're looking to put out some of your own personal content, some larger form content. These options are sort of ways that you can choose how your content is distributed. So, for example, the first option is you can either let viewers buy or rent your work and receive 50% of the net revenue, or you can have your content included into Amazon Prime, in which case you can make the content available on Amazon Prime and earn 15 cents for every hour the content is streamed. You can make your content free with ads. Providers can make their content free with ads and receive 55% of net advertising revenue. Or you can choose to have your content only available on add-on subscriptions. And in that scenario, you would make your content available only to those with add-on subscriptions, but you'd still receive 50% of the net monthly revenue.
I didn't understand that last one. What's an add-on subscription?
I'm not entirely sure, because I thought that the add-on subscription was Amazon Prime in the first place. So maybe that's a new thing that they're starting with this sort of new video streaming service. I know they're constantly like looking for ways to really help out filmmakers, though. I mean, I remember a few years ago, they had this resource. I think they're still doing it. It's Amazon Studios, where anyone can upload anything they've written and then they submit it to Amazon. It's sort of like a community feel, so you can make it public, you can have other members look at your script and provide feedback. We didn't get a whole ton of feedback. We did ask a lot of people to look at it, though, and review it, and we thought that maybe it would help our chances at getting Amazon to pick it up, because that's what the whole point of that platform was for. You submit your content and then they look at it and they can either choose to develop it into a larger series, or they'll actually fund your feature for you. Didn't work out for us, but really, these sort of platforms are just so ideal and everyone should just do them. It's free. So if you have a script or for a web series or even a short or a feature, then you might as well just try it. I mean, you could get like some of the returns on that were like $250,000 in funding, or there's some crazy numbers up there.
Yeah, we should find out if that's still a thing, but it's really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, so I came up in filmmaking at an interesting transition time. My first feature, Jericho's Echo, came out in 2005, and things were just like transitioning, basically. So the film was on Netflix as a DVD. Netflix didn't even have the streaming service yet. And then when streaming started to become more popular, of course, people wanted to access the film that way. So I went through several different iterations. It was on Google Video. It was on a couple of different platforms that no longer exist. And that was like also before Google bought YouTube. So it was, you know, it was before things are the way we know them now, even though we sort of take for granted that the way they are now is the way. And so now I have this film that people can only access currently on DVD, but it's still in demand. It's, you know, people still ask for it. So I've been thinking about, you know, what's the best way for me to get it out there digitally. Of course, it's been like hacked on YouTube, or not hacked. It's been like pirated on YouTube several times, and apparently pirated in China, which I was kind of flattered about, not going to lie. Anyway, I've been considering Vimeo On Demand and Fandor, but now that Amazon Video Direct is launched, I'm pretty tempted. Like the idea that I could upload it myself, have total control over it, and, you know, choose the way I get paid is pretty compelling.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I mean, like Amazon has a pretty wide reach at this point. Like they have apps all over the place. I have it on my PS4. You can just go right into Amazon Prime, and it'd be really awesome to see your movie up there with like Under the Skin and like all these really amazing indies that have come out over the past 3 years that Amazon has been on top of. You know, they're doing good work.
Yes, yeah, so we'll keep you guys posted as we hear from different filmmakers about the success they're having on these various platforms. And please also let us know, you know, if you've tried any of them out.
Yeah.
We want to send a big congratulations out to the directors who were selected for Sundance's new Film 2 initiative. It's basically part of their ongoing artist development programs like the Sundance Labs. And this time it's in conjunction with NBC Universal. They're basically supporting directors who are making their second features. And this is really important, I think more important than you might think. I liked a quote I read by Gina Prince Bythewood, who did Love and Basketball and The Secret Life of Bees. She said, "Making a good first film says you have the potential. Making a good second film says you're the real deal. But getting the second film made is often just as hard as the first." I think that's really true. And so I commend Sundance for taking on this initiative. And the 13 selected fellows include Mariel Heller, who did The Diary of a Teenage Girl, Anna Rose Holmer of The Fitz, which is being released theatrically next week, I think, and Yared Zaleke, who did Lamb. So I was unclear from their press release and the other materials how these selections are made, but you guys should definitely keep an eye out for next year if you've made a feature.
If we see any sort of like application too, we'll write a post about it later on for sure, because that's the sophomore slump is real. It's hard to, you know, make a second feature after sort of having the crazy motivation of going for the first film.
Yeah, and just having made the first film doesn't guarantee you funding on the second. So,
right. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about gear news. It's not much this week. We've generally seen kind of a slowdown after NAB, because NAB was, you know, a huge sort of release platform for companies to be making these announcements. We put out about 101 videos, I think, was the final count, or maybe it was like 106 was the
more
final
than
count.
100.
And we had this huge super post of like all the accompanying articles, which, you know, 106 articles on a page is a little bit hard to digest. So what we've been doing is sort of breaking them down by category into smaller posts, which you can check out categorically. We have videos relating to, you know, VR, lighting, cameras, lenses. Those are all on YouTube too in separate playlists now. So if you haven't had a chance to check out our N&B content, it's much easier to sort of figure out what was going on now. So go on to YouTube, check out our YouTube channel, or just plow through the site and check out those super posts. One thing I did see at NAB that was pretty interesting, I should say that I didn't actually physically see it because I had an 104 degree fever for the first couple days, which was tough, but there's this crazy new VR rig that Google and GoPro have been sort of working on over the past few years. It's called the Odyssey. And this week they announced that they were going to start taking orders for it and shipping. The thing costs $15,000. It looks like a UFO combined with a drone. It has 16 GoPro Hero black cameras on it in a circle and a microphone attached internally. But it's revolutionary for VR in the sense that it's really taking this idea of stitching videos together for 360 video and simplifying it as much as they can. Google has been working on this software that allows users to automatically sync, stitch, and stereo 360 degree video capture. So it's a pretty amazing tool. It's pretty bulky. It costs $15,000, so it's not exactly something that I'm going to be looking for as a filmmaker, especially with the technology being sort of as young and, I guess, unpopular for consumption as it is right now. But, you know, as long as Google and GoPro keep working on what they're doing, we could see smaller versions of this, more affordable versions of this in the near future.
That's true, and it's definitely not the most indie friendly. You can't even get your hands on it directly right now. Like, they're actually accepting applications to receive the whole rig. But another thing you get with it is Google server space, which is essential when you're shooting the amount of video that's required to have a 360 degree picture.
Right. It just goes directly to the cloud, right? It's just you. It's pretty. Yeah. I mean, that's where Google really comes into play with this sort of film technology.
Exactly. And if you're thinking of building, like, it's a smart time to build your business around VR, even if you're indie, because you still have a chance to, like, make an impression get out ahead of other companies.
The barrier at entry is very small right now. Very large?
No, the barrier's
small. The barrier's small. The opportunity is large.
Yes. So if your pocketbook is also large, you can go ahead and, this is sort of the top of the line. And think about it. I mean, you can't get a top of the line cinema camera for any less than this.
Right.
So
that's true. That's true.
Yeah. In post-production gear news, DaVinci Resolve 12 software from Blackmagic was actually just released a few months ago, but they already have a 12.5 in beta, which John mentioned they actually saw at NAB this year. And the 12.5 boasts over 1,000 updates, which sort of makes me wonder why 12 was ever released if the 12.5 required 1,000 updates. But anyway, basically, Resolve is an editing program that incorporates powerful color correction tools. And that's what sets it apart from other post-production software. So we actually recruited a professional colorist to comb through the features and pick out what they thought were the 14 best and most useful. So that review of Resolve 12.5 is on the website now.
So moving on to grant and opportunity deadlines, we've been talking about this for the past two or three Indie Film Weeklies, but just to hammer it in, you have until May 23rd to apply to the San Francisco Film Society Documentary Film Fund grant. It's one of the best documentary grants out there, and they give you a whole bunch of resources in addition to money. So really just
go for it.
Do it.
NYWFT, the New York Women in Film and Television Group, has a couple grant deadlines this month. The Nancy Malone Marketing and Promotion Grant gives $5,000 for a recently completed or currently being completed dramatic feature film directed by a woman. First or second time U.S.-based feature filmmakers are eligible. Unfortunately, films co-directed by a woman and a man are not eligible, but this is a good grant to apply for if you're wrapping up production and you want to get the film out there. It costs more money than you think even to like apply to festivals and do some basic PR. The deadline for that is May 27th. NYWIFT also has a deadline on June 1st for the Loreen Arbus grant. If you happen to be one of the very specific people in this category, you should definitely apply. It's for women filmmakers making a film on physical or developmental disability issues. So it's a disability awareness grant. It's a completion grant for $7,500. And it's close to our hearts this week because our next episode is going to feature the director of and filmmakers from the Real Abilities Film Fest, which showcases filmmakers with disabilities. Another deadline to be aware of, and we have a whole post on the site about this with more details, is the POV deadline. It's one of our country's most acclaimed documentary series. I think it's won the most documentary Emmys. And to submit your film for consideration for their next season, the application deadline is June 15th.
So this is another opportunity we've mentioned previously, but it's one of those ones that you really just can't miss. If you have a film ready, you should submit it to the Austin Film Festival by May 20th. This is one of the last deadlines for you to get it in. It's regarded as one of the best film festivals in the nation. It's 23 years old. It was kind of the precursor to South by Southwest, and Austin is just an incredible city. If you haven't been there, just go get a taste for what it's like to experience that film community firsthand. I think would be really a great opportunity for any filmmaker.
Yeah, Movie Maker Magazine actually named Austin the number one city in which to be a filmmaker recently.
And it's been on Movie Maker Magazine's top 50 film festivals worth the entry fee pretty much every single year. So if you have a film, apply.
There are a bunch of other festival deadlines this week.
Yeah, this one is kind of a funky one. This is a festival that takes place in Oakland, California, so right across from San Francisco. It's called the Brainwash Drive-In Bike-In Walk-In Movie Festival, and it's the original drive-in movie festival, one that still remains today, even though drive-ins are sort of out of fashion. It's been going on since 1995. They attract a lot of weird, funky movies and kind of look for that as a means of curation. They want to be able to display some of the most cutting-edge, weird cinema from up-and-coming filmmakers from around the nation, around the Bay Area, around the West Coast. It seems like a really fun local opportunity if you are a filmmaker in California or in the western states.
That actually does sound really, really fun. There's another deadline for a different regional film festival. On May 25th, the Tall Grass International Film Festival. It's in Wichita, Kansas. It's another one that's been on Movie Maker Magazine's annual 50 film festivals worth the entry fee list. And as a big plus, they offer prizes.
Yeah, they have some really interesting prizes. They offer $2,500 awards for both the winners of the Audience Award in documentary and narrative features. But the most sort of unique prize they have is this award for the Stubbornly Independent Gala. And that is actually twice the amount of money that the documentary and narrative feature awards are. It's $5,000. And in addition to that, the Stubbornly Independent winner also receives a gala screening, a theatrical screening from AMC, and perhaps most importantly, a one-of-a-kind Tallgrass tap handle.
I'm not sure what that is, but cool. If you've got a documentary, one of the most respected film festivals in the country is the United Nations Association Film Festival. Their deadline is May 26th. It takes place at Stanford University, also in California. It's one of the oldest only documentary film festivals in the U.S. And yeah, it's very well respected. It was originally conceived to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So, of course, a lot of these social issue documentaries fit in really well with their mission. They also offer modest cash prizes ranging from $500 to $2,000. As always, we'd like to let you know about some of the indie movies opening across VOD and theaters. So since we missed last week's episode, we'll mention a couple that have been out. as well as some that are coming out while we were out. I Am Talente by Natalie Johns was released. This is an interesting story because it's the first release by the crowdfunding platform Seed and Spark. So if you're not familiar with Seed and Spark, they're like an Indiegogo or Kickstarter, very indie focused in terms of crowdfunding. And they realized that they could capitalize on the audiences built during fundraising for the films to actually help the film's release. So I Am Talente is available on Seed and Spark itself, as well as the other streaming platforms like iTunes. It's a film about a homeless South African skateboarder who was kind of discovered by the American skater Kenny Anderson, and it's gotten some really strong reviews.
Also coming to VOD is the indie Song of Lahore. It's a documentary, a music documentary. It's co-directed by Charmaine Obaid Chinoy, who won the Doc Short Oscar this year for A Girl in the River, and Andy Shokin. It's also playing in select theaters, but you can check it out on video on demand. It's a documentary that follows several Pakistani musicians and asks if there's still room for them in a society roiled by conflict. But sort of the main action of it is that they all travel to New York and they get to do a concert at Jazz at Lincoln Center with Wynton Marsalis. So it's kind of just chronicling their journey and probably, I imagine, the differences between what it's like to be a musician in Pakistan and New York.
Creative Control has come out on Amazon Prime Instant. We actually have several pieces on the site about this film. Sounds like a really weird movie. It stars Benjamin Dickinson, who is the director, and we have an interview with him on the site. And basically, he plays an ad executive who uses an augmented reality technology to basically have an affair with his best friend's girlfriend, kind of virtually. Anyway, we also have an interview with the DP, Adam Newport Barra, on the site. So they all have interesting things to say about an interesting movie.
Sounds interesting. coming out this week in theaters, most of these are limited because we're focusing on independent film. The movie Maggie's Plan, which was sort of a festival darling at Sundance this year of sorts. Actually, I have sort of an interesting story about seeing it. I showed up to a Miles Ahead screening about 4 hours earlier than I should have, just because I was confused because it was my first movie at my first Sundance. So I actually got like the last seat in the premiere screening of it.
Were the actors all there at the screening?
I didn't stick around.
Ah.
I kind of got out of there just because it wasn't really my cup of tea. Even though some of the performances were fantastic. I mean, Ethan Hawke is in it. Julianne Moore is pretty hysterical in it. And Greta Gerwig is also in it. So it's definitely an indie. It was directed by Rebecca Hall, who has a pretty substantial following in this sort of indie world.
Yeah, so it sounds like it got kind of mixed reviews, but
It got kind of mixed reviews, but it was a fun movie. And I think that people are going to go see it because it's just fun.
Speaking of fun.
Yeah, speaking of fun, this next movie is called Wiener. It was another movie that was a massive Sundance breakout, I think. I don't know. I heard a lot about it at Sundance, and I really wanted to see it because, you know, being based in New York, it's pretty relevant. This crazy scandal that happened a few years ago with one of our representatives, Anthony Wiener. He sought the Democratic nomination to run for New York City mayor in 2005 and 2009. But on May 27th, 2011, this guy sent a link to a sexually explicit photograph of himself on his public Twitter account to an adult woman who was following him on Twitter. Apparently, he's been doing this for years, and this wasn't the first instance of him getting caught. It was just kind of the first time it was publicly available for everyone to see. So it was a big story here in New York City, and he actually ended up resigning from office about a month later. So this documentary follows that journey, that embarrassing, embarrassing journey that he had to go through in those couple years. So definitely sounds interesting.
The film Deepan is in theaters now, and looping it all back around to Cannes, it won the Cannes Palme d'Or, the top prize, last year. It's the story of a Sri Lankan refugee who's relocated to the projects in France. So very timely story. And we have an interview with the director of the film, Jacques Audiard, on the site now.
And, you know, actually, tonight they're going to be screening Wiener at the opening night of the Rooftop Film Festival, which is a big film festival here in New York that happens every summer. Lots of fun. Liz, have you ever been to one of those shows before?
Oh my God, it's like one of my top summer destinations in New York. It's actually a screening series that runs all summer long, starting, as John mentioned, this week. There's kind of a more public opening night on Friday with a series of shorts.
Right.
And this year, those include Joanna Arno's Bad at Dancing, which won the Silver Bear Jury Prize at last year's Berlinale. And yeah, it's definitely like one of New York's coolest summer things, because basically they find alternative spaces to screen films, mostly rooftops or outdoor. They have bands play. It's very carefully curated.
Yeah, I mean, they also just announced that they're going to be doing sort of a larger concert series, I guess, this year. Next week, they're going to be doing some screening at the House of Vans in Brooklyn, where there will be screening Danny Brown's new documentary. Danny Brown is a pretty crazy hip-hop artist, if you haven't heard of him.
It's a documentary about
him
by Andrew Kahn, who we just interviewed during Tribeca for his last film, Night School, and now he's got this new film about Danny Brown.
There you go. And it's a concert film that takes place in Detroit, and I think that film was also regional to Detroit area, right?
Exactly. And anyway, Danny Brown's going to perform at the screening. So this is the kind of thing that they do. And if you're in New York at all this summer, there's a film almost every single night once the season really gets going. So highly recommend checking out their schedule.
Definitely.
And now for one of our favorite new segments of the show, Ask No Film School.
So we've been sort of gathering these questions through what you guys have been asking other members of the community on the boards, and we've been selecting our favorites from those. Not necessarily our favorites, I mean, just the ones that kind of caught our eye. But we've sort of realized even in going through these board posts and looking for, you know, questions, that our boards aren't exactly finely tuned, I guess would be a nice way of saying it.
There's room for improvement.
There's definite room for improvement, and we're aware of it, and it's something that we're going to be working on throughout the next year. One member of the community, Jacob Floyd, brought this to our attention. He asked about updates that were being made, and he mentioned how he was frustrated by some of the spam. And we just wanted to sort of, you know, reassure all of you that it's a slow process, especially now that, you know, Ryan is very busy on his film. We are the editorial team, so we're trying to get as much done as we can, but there's a whole other side to the company that is sort of
the technical
located
backend.
It's located somewhere else. It's the developmental team, and they're working on it. It's going to take a while. We're going to be making slow sort of adjustments throughout the year.
I think the same guy that posted that mentioned that he knows that when sort of a new team comes on, there are changes made that are subtle, and that's for sure. So we've actually made several changes and upgrades already to sort of our whole editorial process, and I know some of you have kindly commented on the quality of work on the site and that kind of thing, and it's definitely been improving. And of course, this podcast itself is one of our major newer initiatives. But yeah, we want to assure you guys that we're also continuing to work on the technical back end, and that we're open to your suggestions. You know, you're welcome to continue that thread that Jacob was his name?
Yeah,
that Jacob started.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, give us your suggestions. Of course, we ask you to be cool and not jerks.
And most of you are very cool, so I'm not too
jerks.
Worried about. Yeah, and not jerks. I mean, it seems like a lot of you know sort of how delicate this sort of process can be. I'm sure that a lot of you will probably be upset by some of the changes we make, no matter what the changes are. But some things that we're really looking to try and fix in the immediate future are, you know, creating a notification system that will notify you when someone replies to your comment or your question on the boards. We want to somehow do a overhaul of the navigational structure so that sifting through these boards is less of a nightmare for everyone.
Okay, not nightmare, but so it becomes more convenient for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, so it becomes more convenient. Nightmare nightmare was a word that I lifted from the post itself.
Oh,
so,
man.
That's not exactly my personal experience, but it's tricky, and it could definitely we're definitely working on organizing it better.
So thanks for the feedback.
Yeah, so thanks for the feedback. And seriously, like if you have any more feedback, we'd love to hear it.
We do pay attention.
We do pay attention, as evident by this little section. So.
So another kind of more typical question that we get from the boards and for Ask No Film School is one that comes to us from, this happens almost every week. It seems people that ask the most interesting questions have the most complicated names.
I think it speaks to our international appeal.
That's right. So in this case, the question comes from a name, I'm sorry in advance if I'm butchering, but I'm going to go with first name Ozgun.
This is a tough one.
Last name, Kabakcioglu.
Yeah, I think that's about as good as we're going to get.
Anyway, Ozgun, you know who you are. And you asked us, what does it mean to be a first-time filmmaker? Which might sound like a kind of obvious question, but he goes into the details and says, here's my situation. He's made several short student films. He never sent them anywhere. And now he's made a short documentary that he thinks is festival worthy. So he's asking, is he a first-time filmmaker or not? And I'm assuming he's asking that because the festival has some kind of first-time filmmaker category.
Right. Or even some guidelines or anything. Because, I mean, you know, we go through these grants every week, and some of the grants are specifically pointed towards first-time or second-time filmmakers. So, yeah, how would you define that?
Well, I think, for one thing, as you mentioned, a lot of these grants have very specific guidelines. So the first thing to do is go to the festival site, go to the grant site, and carefully read their application instructions, because it will probably define what it means to them. Like, for example, you know, the Sundance Directors Lab is for first-time feature directors. Mm-hmm. And so it's very specific that it's for first-time makers, except that all of those people are already accomplished filmmakers. They've just only made shorts.
Right.
So it could be that first-time means first feature. In this case, because Ozgun has a short, I think in general it has to do with kind of like what recognition your films have gotten. So if, you know, if this is the first time you're submitting to a festival, then ostensibly, as far as the industry is concerned, you are a first-time filmmaker.
Yeah.
And frankly, like, us indie makers do what we gotta do. So I think anytime you can fit into like a special category or something that would give you, you know, a greater chance of getting a grant, like if there's any way that you could be defined as a first-time filmmaker and it would help you, then go ahead and define yourself as a first-time filmmaker. I don't think there's anything sort of ethically wrong with that.
No, definitely not.
So good luck. Let us know if you get into the festival.
Yeah. This question was asked by Alexander Georgievich, and I'm particularly was interested in it just because, you know, I'm on this week and I don't get the chance to do this very much. And I'm actually a theater major, which is strange. That I'm working here at No Film School now, but, you know.
Probably went to theater school, not film school.
Yeah, I went to theater school, not film school, at NYU. So there was a lot of, you know, in-between cross. It's one of the great things about NYU. We don't have to get into it now. But his question is, I'm not used to playwriting, and I'm currently writing one for a local theater. I know screenwriting and playwriting are somewhat similar, but what are the biggest differences and similarities between them, and do I gain some screenwriting skills while writing a play? Is dialogue different, less visual writing? I have written both shorts and plays. I haven't written a feature yet, but yeah, there are definitely some obvious differences between the two, and I think it really just, you know, it comes to keeping in mind who your audience is, keeping in mind what sort of limitations you have as a playwright versus the sort of expanded limitations of being a screenwriter. I think the more sort of interesting challenges you can work into your play that you would actually want to use in a filmic scenario would end up benefiting you in this case. Obviously, dialogue, it's going to be much more dialogue heavy with a play than with a feature or a film, because that's your main mode of storytelling within a play. Whereas in a film, you sort of have the ability to manipulate where people see at certain times, or, you know, give them a point of view with a play, people are going to be able to focus on the whole world in general. So you have to really keep in mind how that world within that one setting will work for you, and sort of the details that you can highlight within that world that will really help to build the drama and build the plot and build the tension. As far as whether or not it will affect how you write a film, I think, yeah. I mean, I think any time you write really affects anything you write ever. If anything, I would just say everyone should be writing all the time.
But are there other kind of technical differences between the two, like the way you might approach them or the type of words you even use, or is it essentially the same format?
I mean, I think that it's more difficult to write a film like a screenplay because you are writing in the action a lot of times, you know, and you're writing in the settings, and you're giving people sort of it's easier for people to read a screenplay and enter into that world. Whereas, you know, in theater, a lot of the times you don't want to be adding that sort of extra stuff into your script because you want to leave those choices up to your actors. I mean, I think, you know, with screenplays, you're keeping in mind the needs of the director. You're keeping in mind the needs of the cinematographers, the producers. With stage play, it's really only the actors and you as the playwright.
The director, no?
Yes, the directors too, but I feel as if the directors are also interpreting the script rather than looking at it and picking out like written out points. You know what I mean? Like, now we're going to focus on this character, or that's sort of like the work that comes, I think, with being a director in stage rather than in film.
Cool. Interesting question, Alexander.
Yeah. Thanks.
So looks like the show is coming to a close. Thank you, John, for joining me this week. And thanks in advance for producing and editing this show, as always. You all can read about a lot of the topics we discussed in more detail at nofilmschool.com.
And as always, if you guys could continue subscribing and go out there, get on iTunes, put in how many stars you think can qualify or quantify this show, review us, write a nice little thing or a negative little thing. Just, you know, do anything. Just get active out there on those iTunes.
I forgot to mention earlier that the links to all the grant and festival opportunities are available on the post at No Film School that's associated with this podcast. And you can reach us on Twitter. I'm at Liz Film.
And I am at Jim_John_Jim.
And we are at No Film School.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Liz.
So formal.
Thank you very much, Liz, for allowing me to speak.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you guys for joining us, and see you next week.
See ya.